Kentucky is one of two states without any school choice program, and voters overwhelmingly rejected it at the ballot box last year. That's because the education establishment said that it would destroy Kentucky schools. But is that true? Hi, I'm Richard Nelson, host of The Commonwealth Matters. And joining us to talk further about school choice is Greg Brock. Greg is a senior advisor to the American Federation for Children, a group working to pass the Educational Choice for Children Act, or ECCA, at the federal level. Greg, welcome to the program.
Thank you so much, Richard. Grateful for the opportunity.
So I appreciate your time and you joining us. I'm going to reference a survey taken by Fabrizio Lee and Associates. They found that this is a national survey. January 2025 is when they did it, showed that 74% of voters support school choice and 65% of voters support the ECCA in particular. The Senate Opportunity Fund poll in July of 24 showed that 73% of Republicans, 65% of independents, and 64% of Democrats support school choice. Now, Greg, most states have some kind of school choice program, some vibrant and robust program, some just barely have it. Kentucky is just one of two states that does not have it, even though polling is fairly strong here. The polling and the sentiment wasn't enough to overcome the education establishment's objections to it. We were involved with the effort to pass that amendment last year at the ballot box, but we didn't have the money. We didn't have the strength or the firepower to combat a lot of the misinformation, man. Public, you're going to destroy our public schools. This is going to favor the rich. This is only going to help those private schools that are doing well. We heard all of that. And of course it failed at the ballot box. So I guess we'll start with this. The ECCA, is it going to destroy public schools?
Of course not. And actually, Richard, I can relate to your experience being from Michigan. We had a similar situation. Around the time I first got involved in the school choice movement about 25 years ago, we tried to pass a constitutional amendment of our own in Michigan to allow for publicly supported private school choice. And the voters defeated that amendment after we were vastly outspent by the teachers' unions and a lot of liberal special interest groups. And what we found from that experience is that when you've got a complex constitutional amendment that you put directly to the voters, and you combine that with millions of dollars in special interest spending to promote falsehoods and to spread lies and untruths about it, then it's almost certain that you'll see it defeated at the ballot box, because when in doubt, people vote no, and they tend to be protective of at least the local public schools in many cases. But we've seen a lot happen in the last few years. The groundswell of demand for change from parents has really been increasing. I firmly believe that's still there in Kentucky and all around the country, and that if you tried to pass legislation on this, as we're trying to do in Congress, it stands a much better chance because legislators have the ability to sort through all the special interest lies and to study the impact of these school choice programs and the success that they've had at the state level around the country. You look at Florida, you look at Arizona, Pennsylvania. If these programs were going to destroy public schools, you would have already seen that happen in those states, and that's not happening. What they're doing is they're holding public schools accountable by giving parents choices. And yes, some parents are choosing to leave public schools, put their children in private schools because they see better academic quality, they see a safer environment, or frankly, in many cases, especially these days, they see an opportunity to choose a school that reflects and respects their own family's faith and values. So if the sky were going to fall for public schools, we already would have seen that. And actually in Florida, you see public schools responding to that pressure and getting better as a result.
Right. In principle, Greg, competition is a good thing. It makes us better, whether you're a private industry or an educational institution. Competition is a good thing. Americans value choice, right? We want choices. And especially when it comes to education, Parents want choices for their children, and they want the best fit for their children as well. Unfortunately, in Kentucky, they've not had much of a choice when it comes to education. Greg, the ECCA has been proposed the past, I think, several sessions in Congress. Is that correct? How many years has it been proposed?
This is the third congressional session. It was first introduced in June of 2022, and then it was proposed again last session. But the split in party control, with the Democrats having the Senate, made it impossible, essentially, politically, to get it through until this session.
It seems to make sense that Trump would strongly get behind this and spend political capital, especially as he's working to eliminate the federal Department of Education, because he's not against education. He's just for our limited tax dollars being spent in a way that makes sense, and also expanding it into other areas. So let's talk about the ECCA. It's $10 billion of a tax credit. It's where these grant-making bodies would be created, and then they would distribute scholarships to the lower socioeconomic classes. It's $10 billion, again, set up. This is where private individuals and businesses would contribute to these grant-making organizations. It'd be available to all 50 states. Each state would have a minimum of $20 million. And then it gives parents a choice in these states, doesn't it? Greg, is that correct? Was that a good explainer for what this is?
Yes. And I would say on the eligibility front, one thing to clarify is that the eligibility proposed in the bill for scholarships is at 300% of median family income by region around the country. So if you live in the New York City area around Manhattan, of course, the cost of living is going to be very high there, or in DC compared to Omaha, Nebraska, or Frankfort, Kentucky. And so the cost of living, there's going to be a scale, basically, which 90% or more of families in virtually all 50 states will be eligible for this opportunity. But in a state like Kentucky, it's basically going to be a range between, let's say, $225,000 up to a little over $300,000 annual income based on, say, a family of four, as far as who would be eligible for the scholarship. So about 90%, it's a pretty bold and ambitious bill in terms of the eligibility aspect for it. Another thing to emphasize, Richard, is that this is all private funding for scholarships. The only public aspect about it, or federal aspect, is the change in the federal tax code to create the incentive to then raise the dollars from individuals and corporations with a 100% non-refundable tax credit. So that means that, you know, despite what the opponents say, it doesn't take away money from public schools. It simply leverages private philanthropy for a public purpose. It gives individual corporate donors an incentive to contribute to scholarships for families that most likely would never be able to afford private school or other educational services if it were not for this bill. One final thing that about the bill, as far as an explainer, that I would mention is that while one of the main benefits of it is the opportunity for parents to use a scholarship to have their children apply for private school and attend private school, is that there are other eligible uses. Homeschoolers can access scholarships for homeschool expenses. Even if your child is currently enrolled in public school, and let's say your child is very happy, you're happy with the child being in the current public school, but that school is not delivering the best product, perhaps in one subject or another, let's say math, you can apply for an ECCA, Educational Choice for Children Act scholarship, and access scholarship funds to use for supplemental tutoring in that subject, whether it be math or science or something else. So it's not limited to private school choice, although admittedly, many parents will choose to use a scholarship for private school tuition. That'll probably be the biggest group of beneficiaries, if you will, as people looking to access a private school. But I just want to emphasize it's not limited to that.
Greg, our state Supreme Court ruled that EOAs passed by the state legislature, and EOA is an educational opportunity account, very similar to the ECCA, where you'd have private individuals and private businesses donating to a grant-making body, and then that body would distribute scholarships to needy kids, needy families. Our Supreme Court said, well, that's using state, it's actually state supported. You're taking away state tax dollars from public schools. It was a stretch. I don't agree with that ruling, horrible ruling. But this is, could this pass, would this, if it did, could there be a similar objection where somebody challenges at the Supreme Court? Is this even on your radar that somebody could, the major teachers unions would file a lawsuit and take it to the Supreme Court? Is that, or has this kind of thing been supported and upheld in the courts elsewhere?
That's an excellent question. First of all, the difference between this ECCA legislation and what you had in Kentucky is because, of course, this is something legislated in Congress and it's federal and it's strictly about the federal tax code. The Kentucky Supreme Court, thankfully, has no jurisdiction over this. They would not be able to stop this through litigation at the state level. They simply would not have standing. But in federal court, we believe, we're just convinced that the opposition within minutes of passage, or within minutes of President Trump signing the law, that they'll file litigation in federal court to stop it. However, unlike in Kentucky, there is significant federal court precedent already in recent case law in multiple cases. 2011, there was a major case involving the Arizona Tax Credit Scholarship that was decided in federal court. It was called Wynn, W-I-N-N, W-I-N-N versus Garriott. And that decision by the U.S. Supreme Court in federal court upheld the constitutionality of tax credit scholarship programs and also issued protections for, affirmed protections for religious liberty and private school autonomy in terms of the private school involvement in that. So that's just one case. There are multiple cases in terms of precedent at the federal level that are very much on our side. So we are very confident of prevailing in federal court should there be litigation on the issue.
We are going to take a quick break, but we'll be right back. Hi, my name is Richard Nelson, founder and executive director of the Commonwealth Policy Center. We're here to shore up the sanctity of human life, religious freedom, natural marriage, and sound fiscal policies. At the Commonwealth Matters, we have conversations with leading thinkers and policymakers to help us think biblically about the great issues of the day. If you appreciate our work, then please consider a donation today. This work is entirely supported by people just like you. Your gifts and tax-deductible contributions help to underwrite this program, and you help to get this important message out all across the Commonwealth. We believe that the Commonwealth of Kentucky is a great place to live, and we want to keep it that way for our families and our children. That's why we're standing for what's right, for what's good, and what's true right here in Kentucky. Thanks in advance for your support, and may God bless you. Greg, you touched on something that came up when the school choice amendment was on the ballot last year in Kentucky. And that's that there were some conservatives saying, hey, we don't want school choice in Kentucky because it invites the government to somehow control private schools, to mandate curriculum, or to encroach on religious freedom. But you said that this doesn't do that, the ECCA doesn't, because it is in the realm of tax policy and not under the realm of the Department of Education. Can you expand on this a bit more as to anybody out there concerned that this could somehow be the camel under the tent, the camel's nose under the tent to control private education somehow?
Sure. That's an excellent question, one that we have dealt with quite frequently because of the experiences in other states where that has been attempted in terms of trying to either regulate a school choice opportunity to death or to regulate private schools to the point where they have to make a difficult choice, either pull out of the school choice program or accept very burdensome government regulations. Fortunately, the ECCA legislation has, I think, a very strong design and is the limited government approach to doing school choice at the federal level. First of all, it's not a direct appropriation. This is all private money, as I mentioned earlier. So that has it walled off from the beginning from the ability of the opposition to say, well, if you're taking government money at this school, then somehow that gives us the pretext to come in and regulate your private school. Secondly, as I mentioned, not only is all the case law on our side at the federal level in terms of recent precedent on the school choice aspect, but also this U.S. Supreme Court is the strongest, at least in my lifetime, in terms of protections for religious liberty with specific relation to how schools operate under the ministerial exception. They have ruled repeatedly in the last several years that even if it were a direct appropriation, such as the voucher program just right next door to you in Indiana, that that does not allow the government to come in and violate the ministerial exception and dictate to the private school how they ought to teach their curriculum, hire and fire personnel, or admit students, or really anything in terms of violating their autonomy. And then I would say additionally to that, because, again, this is a limited government approach, and because it's a tax credit scholarship and not a voucher or a direct appropriation or even education savings account, it doesn't have to be, and it's not administered by the U.S. Department of Education. It's actually not a new government program in any way. It's a new federal tax credit opportunity. So the oversight is entirely by U.S. Department of Treasury, with no mention of nor any role for the U.S. Department of Education in the bill. In fact, at least hypothetically, if somehow the president and Congress were to succeed in eliminating the U.S. Department of Education next week, it would have zero effect on the ECCA, because the ECCA has no relationship to the U.S. Department of Education. It's not new education policy. It's a new tax policy with the benefit of encouraging donations and support for private school scholarships, educational choice, educational freedom across the board.
That's good. So these scholarships can be used, as you mentioned, for tuition, tutoring, special needs services, education technology, online courses, or curriculum material. It can be used in private schools, homeschools, even for public schools, but they will be administered through state grant organizations. Can you talk a little bit more about how these organizations are created, who will serve there, and then how do they determine who gets the scholarships? Do we know enough about that, Greg?
Sure. So in the bill, it's named as a scholarship granting organization, which is probably the most common term or acronym, SGO, that's given for these types of organizations that operate at the state level doing the exact same thing. And what happens is that SGO forms as a 501c3 charitable organization. As long as they're in good standing with the IRS and they track the donations they receive from individuals and corporations, then under the bill, individuals and corporations can make donations for scholarships and receive the 100% non-refundable tax credit. That would all be tracked at the U.S. Department of Treasury. And then the SGO can take those donations and award scholarships. And the SGO, the scholarship granting organization, determines the size and the recipients of those scholarships. So there's great freedom for the SGO to serve the type of constituency it wishes to serve. For example, you could start an SGO that focused just on helping students who are looking for assistance for homeschool, or just for children with special needs, or just for children who come from families that make a household income of only 150% of median family income. The law will allow you to do it, or the proposed bill will allow you to do up to 300% of median family income. But if you wanted as an SGO to serve the poorest of the poor only and choose the lowest income segment, it allows that flexibility for you to do that. So the tax credit is given to individuals and corporations for their donations to SGOs, and the SGOs award the scholarships. And then enables the parents to choose the school or the educational service of their choice using those scholarship funds.
Very good. And then as far as those serving on the SGO, who might that look like? What kind of people would serve and who appoints them? How does that go? And you might have mentioned it. I could have missed that. But.
Well, sure. So a 501c3 organization, the IRS requires that you have meet certain minimum qualifications to be considered a charitable organization. The state does have a role in each state in terms of regulating and licensing the charitable solicitation. So when you're out there raising money, they have that you have to let them know you're raising money, and you have to let them know, you know, the name of your organization, et cetera. But that the state role is limited to that. The 501c3 must be in good standing with the IRS and must submit to must submit proof to the IRS of an annual independent audit, a non-governmental audit. So as long as they're showing they're in good standing fiscally once a year, in terms of their fiduciary responsibility, and if they have an oversight board, et cetera, then they'll be in good shape for that. Now, you ask what types of people would form an SGO. Obviously, there's going to be great interest in the faith community in particular. I think you're going to see organizations that already have done successful SGOs in other states around the country. Like, for example, the Association of Christian Schools International has a multi-state SGO network already. They're active in states like Missouri and in Georgia, and providing scholarships to disadvantaged families in their in those states, in their constituency. I think you'll see it in among the Catholic Church, the Lutheran faith, the Orthodox Jewish faith. You'll see people of all faiths. You'll see organizations that will form that are not affiliated with a particular faith, but then will serve children from families on a faith basis, as well as a not related to a faith basis. And so the law is not prescriptive in terms of which type of groups that are eligible to form an SGO, so long as they can prove they're in good standing financially and fiscally accountable to the IRS.
Very good. Greg, how does this impact states that already have school choice? We mentioned Texas has a robust school choice program that they just enacted. Indiana, our neighbor to the north, has a good school choice program. Does this impact in any way existing state-level school choice programs?
Yes, and we think in a very positive way. The ECCA scholarships can be stacked on top of whatever existing state-level offerings are available. So if you are a family in Indiana that uses the Indiana Choice Scholarship Program, I believe is the formal name of it, but it's the voucher program. And they also have a tax credit scholarship program there that's separate from the voucher. Either of those programs, if your family is already enrolled, and let's say that your family is sending your child to a private school and they receive a voucher in the amount of $7,000, the ECCA scholarship could add an average of $5,000 to that. So what are the implications for that? It actually puts more educational choices within reach because it empowers parents, gives them more purchasing power. So for example, let's say a family says, well, we know how we're going to be able to afford grade school for our child for private school from K through eight, but we're not sure because high school typically costs more, significantly more, not sure to be able to afford high school. They can access the ECCA scholarship, and that puts high school within reach for a lot of parents who right now can only afford grade school as far as private school for their children. And again, all the various other educational services, homeschool families as well, just simply increases their purchasing power, and it's additive to the existing state level offerings. And then in those states that don't have school choice programs or have very limited restrictive programs, the ECCA will either bring it into that state for the first time, like in my state of Michigan or your state or Commonwealth of Kentucky, or in the states that are very restrictive, it will either expand eligibility and or give them much more purchasing power at the same time.
Yeah, this is welcome news to many Kentucky parents who are deprived of having school choice opportunities. And our hope is that this passes. This would be, I think, a really good thing for Kentucky. But the reality is it has to pass Congress. Right now, as I mentioned earlier in the program, there are 180 co-sponsors in this Congress, if I'm correct. Only two Kentucky congressmen are co-sponsoring, Brett Guthrie of the 2nd District and Andy Barr in the 6th District. And I hope that five out of six of our congressmen are Republicans. Two of our U.S. senators are Republicans. Hopefully they'll get on board as well. Greg, here in the last couple minutes, tell us where it is right now in Congress. Has it been heard in committee? And then what do you think will happen as far as the likelihood of it getting a vote in the full House of Representatives?
Well, Richard, that's why our conversation today is so timely, is because I think we're on the verge of getting a hearing in the House Ways and Means Committee for the bill as part of the overall budget and tax reconciliation package that everybody hears the president describing as the one big, bold, beautiful bill that he wants to achieve. And so the ECCA can be rolled into that because it's a tax bill. And that means it's also exempt from the filibuster in the Senate. So it's really important for your listeners and other school choice supporters to contact their members of Congress. Kentucky doesn't have any representatives on the House Ways and Means Committee, but all of your members of Congress, they all speak to each other, and they can certainly speak to their colleagues and encourage them to back the strongest possible version of the ECCA legislation in House Ways and Means Committee, and then also the same thing in the Senate, because it's the Senate Finance Committee that will decide the tax provisions of this budget reconciliation bill. And then to encourage them to support the entire package on the floor in both the House and the Senate. Yes, we're grateful to Congressman Andy Barr and Congressman Brett Guthrie for being co-sponsors this session. Senator Rand Paul co-sponsored both of the last two sessions. He's not on the bill this session yet, but we think that's simply just a function of he hasn't gotten around to it, but it's very possible that he'll co-sponsor very soon. And of course, we're also very hopeful that Senator McConnell will eventually co-sponsor, as well as Congressman Comer and Rogers and Massey, and at least support it on the floor. So if folks can contact their members of Congress, now is a great time to do that, because the next few weeks will really be crucial in terms of not only determining whether or not the bill passes, but in determining whether or not a meaningful version of the bill passes intact.
Yeah, very good. Do we have a toll-free number for Congress where voters can leave a message for their congressman?
Well, the best way for people to access their members of Congress, make sure their voice is heard, would be to go to federationforchildren.org. And if you go up to the very right corner, upper right corner of the homepage there, there's going to be a button that says Take Action. That will connect you to your member of Congress with an email there, and also contains their contact information for the individual congressional offices. So that's federationforchildren.org. And you can enter your information there and send a message immediately to Congress, or you can simply just go to that page and learn more about the bill and study that first before you take action. But obviously, it'd be really helpful if folks read a little bit about the bill and then contact their member of Congress to urge support.
Greg Brock with the American Federation for Children, thank you so much for joining us on the Commonwealth Matters. God bless you and keep up the good work.